Our practical significance sponsor, Metacress, announces its Future Research Leaders Fellowship, a 7-month international fellowship designed to prepare the next generation of research leaders. Fellows receive advanced training in research methodology, biostatistics, systematic reviews, meta-analysis, scientific writing, and AI-powered research while working with international mentors and a global network of researchers. To celebrate the 20th anniversary of Metacress, the inaugural fellowship is offered at no cost to selected participants. Applications open August 1st and close October 1st, 2026. Learn more and apply at metacressai.com/fellowship. Thank you, Metacress, for your continued support of the Practical Significance Podcast, and congratulations on your milestone anniversary.
Hello, and welcome to Practical Significance, a podcast to inspire listeners with compelling stories from statistics and data science and to propel data-driven careers forward. Here are your hosts, the ASA's Associate Executive Director, Donna Lalonde, and Executive Director, Ron Wasserstein.
Well, welcome everyone to the September issue of Practical Significance. We are very excited to be here, and we have a guest who may be unfamiliar to our community. And so we're really delighted to be able to have a conversation with Megan Parker. And Megan, I'm going to start as I usually do, which is to ask folks to tell us about their day job and maybe a little bit about your history, but also tell us about the Council for the Advancement of Science Writing as you are describing your work and your role there.
Great. Well, thank you so much for the invitation and the opportunity to talk with you today. The Council for the Advancement of Science Writing is committed to improving and increasing the quantity and quality of science news that reaches the public. Our programs are designed to help reporters and writers produce accurate and informative stories about the full range of science topics, including technology, health, medicine, climate, environment, astronomy, space, really anything at all that has a scientific basis, which is pretty much everything in our world. So it is quite a large beat at the end of the day. We are really honored to be led by a council of 15 veteran science journalists and others committed to science communication. And we partner with the National Association of Science Writers, which is the membership association for all science journalists and communicators, to co-organize the annual conference called Science Writers. I joined CASW after spending many years involved with the Society of Environmental Journalists, and I was the writer editor for their environmental program. And I worked there for 15 years during a time of really incredible change in our media landscape. We covered a pretty niche area, environment and security, how environment is connected to conflict and can be used to build peace. And we had a pretty niche audience. But what I saw is when you know your audience and meet their needs for news and are able to engage them directly, you can have a real impact on the decisions that are made, particularly when you are trying to communicate science to policymakers. A lot of policymakers, decision makers of all kinds, most of us, including myself, don't have a rigorous science background. We don't have much training in math and science beyond secondary school. So having folks that are able to translate scientific information, data, in a way that folks without that training and understanding can understand and then use that information to make informed decisions, it's a really powerful role. So I was lucky enough to have gotten to know CASW through a partnership that SEJ has with CASW and the healthcare journalists called the Science Health Environment Reporting Fellowship, which is an incredible program for early to mid-career journalists that are interested in covering that intersection of issues. And when Roz Reed, another amazing woman, decided to retire from CASW, I met with the board. I said, I'm really interested in this job because I'm interested in working on how to encourage more philanthropic support for science, health, and environmental journalism as a way to support sustainable careers in the field. And the council, as I said, is, you know, made up of veteran science journalists who have very long careers in this field and are also extraordinarily concerned about the future of it. And so they said that they were also interested in pursuing that. So that was one of the reasons I decided to take the job with CASW, is because it is uniquely positioned to really work on these long-term challenges facing the field. So it's really quite a unique organization, and I think well positioned to help the field navigate this incredibly uncertain time.
Megan, thanks. Sounds like you've had quite a journey so far. And we want to ask you to reflect on that journey a little bit and say how the landscape for science journalism has changed since you started.
You know, if you go back to 2008, that's really a major tipping point for a lot of things in this country and the world, but particularly for journalism, it serves as kind of a before and after point. That the recession in 2008 was the final blow to what had been an ongoing kind of draining away of advertising and subscriber income, which had long been the main source of revenue for journalism. Craigslist killed local advertising pretty thoroughly, and then the growth of the internet and online communications really started chipping away at that subscriber base. And that's across the board. For science, health, and environment specifically, as the impact of that recession hit the budgets of news outlets, we saw immediately a number of layoffs, and those layoffs disproportionately affected people in journalists covering science, health, and environment. At SEJ, in the membership trends, you can see this really steep drop off at about 2010 when everything sort of finally kicked in. And you can see the shift, this really immediate shift in that time frame from most folks having staff positions to almost half of them being now freelancers. So folks were laid off or they took buyouts and they started freelancing. We also saw people form their own online news outlets out of that. So it wasn't all bad news. There was also a lot of innovation and really trying new things and new incredible journalism being done outside of the traditional media space through these new online news outlets. I mean, if you look at something like Inside Climate News, it started out quite small, but then a couple of years later won a Pulitzer Prize and shocked everybody. Here is this startup news outlet without a paper, without anything that standard bearers have had, and was able to do award-winning work. And that has continued just to expand and flourish. In science journalism, similar to environmental journalism, also saw a lot of layoffs. These beat science, health, environment have long been considered fringe beats. They're not core to a traditional news outlet. Core would be politics, sports, business. These are the things that they have to have, that they have to cover. Whereas science, health, environment was considered, oh, yeah, we'll do a story here or there, but it wasn't something that they needed to do in order to maintain the core audience. And we still see some of the larger mainstream news outlets, they will staff up in on a topic, climate or health during the pandemic, of course, became a hot topic. And so there was additional coverage or staffing, but then it'll go down. So we now see this much more roller coaster effect. Longer term trends that have stuck, of course, the whole magazine industry really suffered from the loss of advertising and the move online. And a lot of science journalism was and is done through magazines. So that had a disproportionate effect on science journalism in particular. At the same time, we've seen a flourishing in the science communication space, leveraging all of the tools that are now available to people without journalism backgrounds or training. Scientists were able to speak directly to the audience, right? In essence, in some ways, filling a lot of these gaps left by the loss of the journalism jobs. I think it is absolutely critical to science that we have venue and forum for editorially independent news and information that can more objectively evaluate the research that's being produced, its impact on society, and what is right or wrong about it. With the decline of science journalism as a core part of the news, we really risk losing that. And that not only has potentially dangerous consequences for science and scientific research and the public's understanding and, most importantly, trust in it, but also for our democracy and the role that the public plays in making decisions about science.
Thanks, Megan. Now we want to turn the focus to the statistical aspects of science writing. As you know, uncertainty is kind of our bag, and we expect that it's probably a challenge in science writing, because when you're reporting on a study, it would be real easy to overstate the findings, ignoring the uncertainty, or to do what I like to do as a statistician, which is to qualify everything, which is not necessarily useful to your readers. So what can we do as statisticians to help writers convey uncertainty? And beyond that, are there any other statistical concepts that are particularly hard to write about for a general audience?
I'll just say that I think all of them are hard to write about for a general audience. I won't say all, there is many exceptions to this, but a lot of journalists go into writing because math was not their strong suit. Now, in science journalism, there is a cohort of journalists who have left scientific training, who were in graduate programs or who even got PhDs and then decided writing and journalism was what they wanted to do. So those folks have a much better grasp because they have had significant training in math, science, and statistics. But that is not the average journalist or even the average science, health, or environmental journalist. So most of them need a lot more assistance in understanding statistics in particular. They may have a pretty firm grasp of a specific topic area that they have been, especially if they've been covering it for a long time. But often those core principles of statistics and data, especially for earlier to mid-career journalists, is something they've just tried to learn on the job, which is, you know, not the best way to do it, right? Because it doesn't give you any kind of wide exposure or thorough grounding. To your point about uncertainty, our entire society has a huge challenge with evaluating risk and dealing with uncertainty. Right? Very human thing to do is to just really say, I can't deal with this nuance. I need to know, is the answer yes or no, right? We have a very black and white approach, especially when we're talking about things we don't know very much about. And so the more somebody understands, the more comfortable they are with the uncertainty or nuance. But again, that's not most of the public. So even when journalists themselves have a higher comfort level with that uncertainty or a better understanding of the underlying data and statistics on it, they still have to communicate it to a public who does not. So there's two steps to this challenge. There's the journalists understanding it, and then the journalists putting it in a way that the public can understand. And there are a number of other pressures not on them, not just the public's own comprehension. There's also time. Time, this in our the 24/7 news cycle, right, does not leave a lot of time for journalists to ponder deep thoughts or to read every study that's ever been published about something, or even to call multiple people sources for a story, right? There are folks that are writing three stories a day, and they are held to this metric. And given again, the job, the uncertainty out there in the instability in the field, they want to hit those metrics so they keep their job. Now, a lot of other science writing is on a longer time frame and they do have more time. But even then, there's always deadlines. So, you know, one thing I know is helpful across the board, no matter what beat or field you're talking in, understanding that journalists are on a deadline and they will publish when that deadline hits. And so if they call you, you want to call them back as soon as possible. They're on a different time scale. It's not the academic time frame. They may be publishing tomorrow. So if you want to have a chance of helping them better communicate something as complicated as uncertainty or risk, this is one reason I'm so pleased about our opportunities to work together, is because I think that if we do build better relationships between journalists and statisticians, they'll be able to work together to help improve the coverage of any issue that has, and all of them do, questions about certainty and risk.
So Megan, you and I have chatted. Our community is really interested in being good partners. You've mentioned the notion of timeliness, right? But are there other ways that you can see statisticians and data scientists, so ASA members, building their working relationship with journalists? What does that look like? So timeliness for sure, but other things that you can share with us?
Yeah, I think, you know, the gold standard is and has always been the opportunity to build face-to-face personal relationships, right, of trust, because that's what it comes down to. Journalists need to know there is a source that they can trust, and this, similarly, the sources want to trust the journalists to treat them fairly and to do a good job with the information they provided. And those relationships are really hard to build just online. Can be done. It is much more powerful when folks are able to work together, preferably in person or at least in the closest analog to it like this. So ideally, we would see statisticians coming to the journalism conferences and vice versa. We see journalism's going to the statistician conference because those are the places where people build relationships of trust in their field. And so seeing that interest on both sides and then creating opportunities for them to engage and really find ways to share the challenges and concerns and opportunities on both sides of this, I think would be a really powerful step. Unfortunately, it does take a lot of time and a fair amount of money to do that, right? So what could we do short of that? I think the webinar that we did together is a great example of an opportunity to build relationships and bring in new folks who might not have ever thought about, hey, maybe I need to not just talk to the expert on this particular topic, but also talk to a statistician because I'm struggling with the data and information in the studies and what this scientist has been telling me. I'm not able to really evaluate it. Who could help a statistician? So I think the first step is just making that people aware of that opportunity. A lot of folks don't really realize that corrections, like if a news outlet has to publish a correction, that is a very negative thing for a reporter. It is not just like, we screwed up. It's something that they are judged on in their careers. So they really don't want to be inaccurate. And so saying, hey, this will help you be more accurate and more effective and help your readers more, I guess that's a point that we can make together through these webinars and hopefully some other outreach to journalists.
Just following up on that, are there other resources that if you had your wish list of what the ASA and other organizations, but the ASA could provide, what would be top on that wish list of resources?
There are a couple of tools out there. I was looking at our connector database, which I recommend to folks if you know something that thinks we should include in it. It's a resource database for science journalists where we are looking for tools, tips, reports, anything that's addressed to science writers that will help them do their job better. And there's a couple of things in there already. There is a great course on reporting with numbers that PBS did, SciLine course, Stats Essentials for Math-Averse Reporters. There's the data course that CASW and ASA already worked together on, which has been proven very effective for early career reporters. Again, all of these things take some time and initiative on the part of the journalists to access, and often they need help. looking at specific topics, right? Because there may be a reporter out there that just covers statistics, but for the most part, they are covering it as part of whatever their subspecialties are on the beat. And so looking specifically, well, what are the key statistical issues? Where is the biggest uncertainty in each field? And working towards the most important things you need to know about uncertainty data and statistics when you're covering, you know, outer space, when you're covering synthetic biology. So looking at some of these hot subtopics and thinking, well, what is it in there where that intersects with hot topics and statistics? And then putting that in the form of a very simple tip sheet is something we could get into the hands of the folks that are covering those topics.
I'm considering that a challenge to our community, Ron. We're going to have to act on that, right?
So, Donna, that's right. It's a challenge for us. And let me turn then to more about what we as a community can do. So some of our podcast listeners, members of our community who might want to get into writing and communication themselves, do you have any general advice on how to go about starting there or specific places or venues you'd point them toward?
The key thing with any writing or communication is you just got to start doing it. And writer's block is real. The tyranny of the blank page is something that every single communicator and writer and journalist I've ever talked to struggles with. So scientists would not be alone if it seems daunting to even just get started. But sometimes you just got to do that. My best advice on conquering that blank page is create an outline. People spend a lot of time trying to make things pretty or compelling or convincing, and they get stuck there, right? Just start with a really basic, fact-based bullet points of what you want to say and worry about the other part later. Figure out what it is you want to say, what are the key points, and then start with that. After that, then you have a plethora of options in terms of modality for communicating. And that comes down to personal preference, what you feel comfortable using, whether it's writing a op-ed or a blog post, or it's doing a YouTube series or just a vertical TikTok video or Twitter or Blue Sky or anything else, right? These are all options available to everyone, and they all have their pros and cons, their pluses and minuses. So it's a question of both of what you're comfortable with, what you want to invest your time doing, because you don't want to be something you hate. So you got to pick something that you're really into doing. And then the other side of it is where your audience is. I think that's something that often gets put off to the end, but really should be part of that initial decision making. If your audience isn't on Twitter, don't invest in Twitter, right? If your audience loves newsletters, then you really want to develop a newsletter. So you have to have some really good idea of who your target audience is and where they're getting their information. And that's also very dynamic at this moment, right? We've seen platforms come and go. We've seen platforms change in ways that have been positive and negative. We're less than 20 years into this big shift, and we've seen some things just disappear entirely, and with it, those people's audiences, right? People who spent years developing big audiences on Facebook or Twitter for then it to become, you know, far less effective. So the advice I've been hearing a lot recently from media experts is, whatever you do, make sure that you have a direct line of communication with your audience that is unmediated entirely by one of these platforms. So yes, you might want to do TikTok videos, but you want to have some other way you are reaching your core audience that is yours, that you own, that cannot go away should TikTok decide to close its doors or sell it off for parts to someone else, right? So right now, that's where newsletters are playing a big role. Or you've seen folks shift to LinkedIn because it feels like a more professional community that than, say, some of the broader social media audiences. So really think not just about first what you're willing to do, because you don't want the format to be a barrier, but then also where your audience is. In terms of where to look for other support, I always recommend SciLine. They do a lot of training both with journalists and with scientists. And so they have a really good handle on both sides. Oh, and then if you're at a university, of course, your university research communications office or PIO team, often those folks have journalist backgrounds. I mean, not all of them, of course, but many of them will be former journalists or maybe do freelancing science journalism on the side, and they can be very helpful. And their job is to help you. So I always suggest talking with them as well. In terms of outlets, I always recommend The Conversation. All of their articles are written by scientists, and they have an incredible team of editors. And I know many of the editors there who are all veteran journalists and who, you know, are willing to invest the time in helping scientists edit their pieces to a place where the public can understand. And I'm a big fan of what they do. But, you know, there are also a lot of more niche blogs like the one that I wrote that are also always looking for scientists to write about their issues and their research.
Megan, I'm curious about what your current thinking is about AI and the impact on writing. I read the op-ed in the Times last week. I think it was last weekend. Never let AI write for you or never write with AI. So what are you hearing from your community and what are you thinking about AI?
Boy, this is the big question, right? At every meeting it comes up, I always call it, I'm like the conversation stopper, because people are like, what about AI? And everybody goes, what about AI? And I think there are so many questions. So it's even hard to know where to start. On the very practical level, for people who are writing and communicating, especially if that is your job, as it is for a journalist, there are very serious consequences to making mistakes with using AI. Plagiarism, making up quotes or people, inaccuracies, these, we all know that AI does this, right? That it hallucinates and that it can present other people's writing as its own. So I 100% agree. You cannot just take what it spits out and publish that. As a journalist, you will be fired. And there have been a number of folks that have been fired because of doing that. And again, none of it was malicious or intentional. It's simply the speed at which people are working and the complexity and amount of information they're trying to process and the staffing cuts. There used to be multiple editorial passes before anything was ever published. And that is very rare now outside of the biggest and most well-resourced publications. On the other hand, it's an incredible tool, right? It's an incredible tool for doing research, for analyzing data, for all of this stuff, right? And so reporters are going to use it for that, especially given the time pressures they're under, but also because it's going to produce really fascinating new stories and insights, right? But you have to understand how it works, and you have to make sure that you have a fact-checking and review process that is extraordinarily thorough. Whenever there's a new tool, it's here to say we're not going to put the genie back in the bottle anytime soon. And so I've had conversations with folks who are like, why should we support journalism when we get all our information from AI? And I was like, but AI is getting its information from journalism. So if you take journalism out, what's left, right? How are we going to ensure that those results are informed by information that has been through the editorial process that journalism has perfected and that is independent? Again, editorially independent of the source of funding for that information.
Well, thanks so much, Megan. This has just been a fantastic conversation. We do have a tradition where we always ask our guests what they're reading or listening to or watching. So got a recommendation for us on what to read, watch, or listen?
Yeah, I'm a huge music fan. I've been my whole life. And right now, I can't stop listening to the new Strokes album, Reality Awaits. It's really good. A little controversial, but really, really good. I've also been really into this new wave of post-punk bands that are coming out of Ireland, like Gilliband and the Gurriers. And I've been exploring, it's newer for me, experimental jazz and sort of the weird side of electronic music. And it's just a lot of really innovative and interesting things going on in music, despite the industry suffering from what I see is a lot of similar parallels to journalism. You know, there's a real undermining of the traditional revenue base for music, but it has led to a real flowering on innovative but smaller ways to find new music and engage with bands. My secret plan after I'm done with journalism is to figure out how to raise philanthropic funding to support rock and indie music, unlike classical or jazz, which has a long history of philanthropic support that isn't the case in these other fields. So I would love to try to figure that out.
That's great. And thanks so much for the recommendation. And we have a final tradition on Practical Significance, and that is Ron's top 10. So I'll turn it over to my colleague, Ron, for the top 10.
Thank you, Donna. Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey was a big hit this summer. I'm sure many of you have seen it. Like me, you probably read the story in high school or college, almost certainly against your will. Now, if you read it, or the Cliff Notes version, as a statistician, you might notice certain things. Here is the Practical Significance Podcast top 10 list of things a statistician sees when reading the Odyssey. Number 10, all three people who were sent ashore ate the lotus. There was no control group. Nonetheless, Odysseus was wise to end the experiment. Number 9, choosing a cave in the land of the Cyclops via convenience sampling produced the unsurprising results of death and mayhem. Number 8, the crew clearly conducted a poor risk analysis before opening the sack of wind. Number 7, Circe certainly did not get informed consent before turning the crew into pigs. Number 6, Tiresias's prophecy that Odysseus would return to Ithaca was a point estimate only, albeit a very graphic one. Number 5, by being lashed to the mast when approaching the island of the Sirens, Odysseus pre-registered his research plan so he couldn't p-hack later. Number 4, the choice of sailing close to the sea monster or close to the whirlpool is obviously an expected value calculation. Number 3, a plot of travel time during his journey flags 7 years with Calypso as an outlier. Number 2, Athena would be viewed as an unmeasured confounder. And the number 1 thing a statistician would see when reading the Odyssey, we would suspect data manipulation in the symmetry of 10 years at Troy and 10 years getting home. Well, that's it for this episode of Practical Significance. We look forward to continuing the conversation next month.
Distinguished colleagues, Medicris is pleased to introduce the Future Research Leaders Fellowship, a 7-month international program designed to prepare the next generation of research leaders for the age of artificial intelligence. The fellowship brings together research methodology, biostatistics, AI-powered research tools, mentorship, and international collaboration. Its aim is to help selected fellows develop the knowledge and practical skills required to conduct high-quality scientific research and produce meaningful scientific outputs. This program is especially meaningful for Medicris, as the organization will celebrate its 20th anniversary next year. To mark this important milestone and give back to the global research community, the inaugural Future Research Leaders Fellowship will be offered completely free of charge. All educational and program-related costs for selected fellows will be fully covered by Medicris. For Medicris, this is not simply a scholarship. It is an investment in the next generation of research leaders. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Practical Significance, the podcast of the American Statistical Association. A new episode will be coming your way next month from AmStat News, the ASA's monthly membership magazine.